case is Brandon Timmons against Bohinski. And Ms. Montgomery, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Sophie Montgomery for the appellant, Mr. Brandon Timmons. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. Mr. Timmons provided a declaration summary judgment stating that when he attempted to file a grievance against the appellee and defendant, Mr. Bohinski, officers told him that, quote, inmates who file grievances against Bohinski get the shit beat out of them. The district court rejected this declaration as, quote, conclusory and self-serving. But under Rule 56 and this court's precedents, that is plainly not an accurate statement or an appropriate basis for summary judgment. Now, on appeal, Mr. Bohinski asks this court to impose corroboration requirement and a requirement that litigants in Mr. Timmons' position name the prison employees that render grievances unavailable to them via threats. But neither requirement has any basis in the law. For those reasons, this court should vacate and remand for further proceedings. So to start, this declaration was competent evidence for summary judgment purposes, and the district court plainly should not have rejected it as conclusory and self-serving. As the non-moving party at summary judgment, what Mr. Timmons needed to do was point to competent evidence such that a reasonable jury could return a verdict for him. And that's what he did.
It seems like the gap, if there was one, in the declaration is the identities of the speakers. Can you speak a little bit to that and whether or not it's relevant under our law?
It is not relevant under the law. There's no, so the relevant substantive legal test for whether grievances were in fact rendered unavailable by intimidation or threats is this court's Rinaldi case, which says that first, the prisoner must have been actually subjectively deterred, and second, a reasonable person of ordinary firmness and fortitude would have been so deterred. There's no reason that a reasonable prisoner of ordinary firmness and fortitude would not be deterred from filing a grievance against an official whose name they do not know. I think there are lots of reasons that don't merit any kind of skepticism by a court that an individual in Mr. Timmons' position wouldn't know the name of the official threatening them.
And I could understand the district court sort of like looking past the identity gap on the subjective prong of that test, but also being interested in when evaluating whether there's a dispute of fact on the objective side. If there's not enough evidence to allow either party to really go depose this person who allegedly says these things, and we are at a point in the case where it's your client's burden on an affirmative defense, isn't there some latitude on Rule 56 to say that that gap means there's not a genuine dispute on the objective prong of Rinaldi?
So I think I'd like to start in responding to your question by addressing the way the burden shifting works here. So, we're at summary judgment. Obviously, only Mr. Bohinski moved for summary judgment. Mr. Timmons does have the burden of persuasion on the availability question. But what the way that the summary judgment standard interacts with the burden shifting is that once Mr. Timmons pointed to competent evidence that, could establish the availability issue, to win summary judgment, Mr. Bohinski needed to do something to negate that. And he didn't. So, Mr. Timmons didn't come. Mr. Bohinski, excuse me, didn't come back with anything to negate Mr. Timmons' showing. And so, because of the fact that Mr. Timmons was a non-movement, that just means that Mr. Bohinski can't prevail at summary judgment. And that is just how summary judgment works.
So let's reorient a little bit around the standard, because Rinaldi talks about fact finding on the exhaustion issue, which I think is distinct from a summary judgment posture, puts the district court in a position to resolve fact disputes. Can we read this decision as Rinaldi fact-finding, rejecting the declaration?
No. Under this court's Small and Palladino cases, if the district court wanted to engage in that kind of fact-finding, it was required to give notice that it was going to do so and to give the parties an opportunity to adduce additional evidence. In Palladino, this court reversed for failure to do that, to provide that kind of opportunity. The district court did not purport to be proceeding under Small and Palladino. Mr. Pinsky has not argued that that's what happened here.
Was Palladino with us on a summary judgment decision or a 12B6 decision?
It was a summary judgment decision. I'd also note that if this court were to vacate and remand for further proceedings, as we've asked, Purtue sort of changes the landscape a little bit in terms of what the next steps may be. But assuming that the district court, you know, wanted on remand to try to engage in fact-finding, you know, there may be some briefing about Purtue issues. But that might be an available course of action, but that is not what the district court purported to do here. I'd also just like to make a second point in response to your earlier question about the sort of absence of sufficient material in the declaration for Mr. Bohinsky to kind of give any meaningful rebuttal. I would back on that. Declaration here gave specific facts, right, which is why it's not conclusory. It said what exactly was said, the dates on which it was said, some details about the people who said it, including that the second person wasn't wearing a name tag, where it was said, right, D block. I'm not defense counsel. I'm sure that they could come up with more creative, different ways of doing it. But just for example, Mr. Bohinsky and the prison's counsel could have taken the schedules for the 16th and the 27th, looked at who was working, you know, the pay records, cross-referenced them against prison logs, looked at the 12 people that could have been in those locations at that time, and either gotten declarations from those 12 or 6 people or deposed Mr. Timmons, showed pictures, right? I think that...
Was it their burden? Like, if we assume that we're going to stay on the summary judgment pathway, was it the defendant's burden to do that, though? I think that's...
It was not the defendant's burden to do that, too. Like, the defense could not have... Mr. Timmons could not have won summary judgment, right, because he didn't move for summary judgment. But if Mr. Bohinsky wanted to win at summary judgment, then yes, as I said, because Mr. Timmons pointed to competent evidence establishing a genuine dispute of material fact, Mr. Bohinsky needed to negate that in some way, and he didn't. I'm not saying that that's the only way he could have done it. But
how could Bohinsky have won summary judgment? Let's say they got the declarations from the 16 people or whatever, or took Timmons' deposition, and he says whatever you want him to say. Doesn't Timmons just continually point to his declaration and say, hey, now it's just a swearing match, so I still get past summary judgment?
Because it's still a dispute of material fact.
Very likely that's the case. I think, you know, and you know, that's how summary judgment works. If there's a dispute of material fact, if there are two competing narratives, then that's not for the judge to determine at summary judgment. I do think, you know, the standard is a genuine dispute of material fact. So in a hypothetical case, there could be certain types of evidence. I think of, you know, the sort of the Scott versus Harris, you know, case about the video chase, not suggesting that that's the only way, but there could be cases in which there is not a genuine dispute of material fact because a reasonable jury, reasonable fact finder could not find for the non-moving party at trial.
And I guess the other option here too is small, right? Assuming Purtue doesn't change the analysis here, is going the small path.
Exactly. That's right. And that would be, you know, again, subject to potential Purtue issues, which the district court did not have the benefit of the first time around because Purtue was decided a couple of months after the summary judgment decision. That would be, an available course for the district court.
Let me ask you a question about deterrence. We talked about the objective side of things. Let's talk about the subjective side of things. Your friends on the other side say there is no way there was no deterrence here. Mr. Timmons was familiar with the grievance process, filed grievances before and after this. So how was there deterrence here? Can you respond to that statement from them?
Absolutely. So I'd like to make, I think, two points in response. So first is, again, I think Rinaldi addresses this. Rinaldi is directly on point. Rinaldi makes clear that the fact that the plaintiff has successfully filed unrelated grievances isn't dispositive on whether the grievance pathway was available for this particular grievance. And here, the threats at issue were very narrowly about Bohinsky, right? Inmates who file grievances against Bohinsky get the shit beat out of them. If you file another grievance against Bohinsky, you're going to get jumped. So looking at kind of the Rinaldi language around the subjective standard, I think, you know, it makes perfect sense that from those very specific threats of targeted personal violence made by people with control over the grievance system and with some, you know, authority over folks in the prison, that would have, as Mr. Timmons said it did, made him too scared to file grievances. And to that point, and I think this is my second point, Mr. Timmons did file 22 grievances in the second half of 2021, right? But many of them are about things like you know, medicine, telephone access. And it is true that six of them were about problems with staff, but we don't have those in the record, right? We don't know that they're about Bohinsky. The fact that Mr. Bohinsky doesn't say they were, I think, creates at least a genuine, you know, dispute of material fact that these were not sufficiently related to the Bohinsky threats that they would be relevant in the way that Rinaldi contemplates. Then actually a third point that I'm just thinking of as I'm standing here, I think if anything, a reasonable inference could be that because Mr. Timmons is obviously, you know, savvy, capable of navigating that system and understands the importance of doing so, as evidenced by the fact that he has exhausted, you know, or filed grievances in 22 other cases in the second half of 2021, I think that that shows, or the reasonable inference is that there was some kind of external, you know, why didn't he do that in this case? Perhaps because, as he said, he was intimidated and frightened and deterred from doing so by these threats by prison officials.
Do you have a view about whether the exhaustion facts are intertwined with the allegations, you know, comparing it to Purtue and how we should think about that?
Yeah, it hasn't been briefed. So if the court were interested in going down that pathway, I think we'd like the opportunity to brief it. I do think there is an argument. As in Purtue, here there is a First Amendment retaliation. There's a retaliation claim. Obviously, the difference that in Purtue, the prison employee who made the threats was also the defendant. In this case, the declaration says that Bohinsky was a supervisor and was acting as a supervisor. So I think it's possible that there may be, you know, an argument that Mr. Bohinsky was exercising his sort of supervisory authority to enlist other guards on his kind of retaliation campaign. But I think this issue would really benefit from further briefing. The district court, you know, hasn't considered this on the merits.
How would you think about, like, there's a timing issue in this case, like the time frame in June 2021 between the allegation, the substantive allegations and the exhaustion issue is, it's within 2 weeks or so. How should we think about the timing link relative to the intertwinement language in Purtue?
Yeah, I mean, two thoughts. First, actually the first threat was on the same day. So there was the underlying incident and then kind of in the same paragraph of the declaration, that same day I filed my grievance and I was told that inmates who file grievances against Bohinsky get the shit kicked out of them. So in that sense, I don't think there is a potential timing issue. But then I don't know that the timing would be a problem if...
I was suggesting the other way, that timing could suggest intertwinement.
Oh, yes. In that sense, I agree. I also think in the third paragraph of the declaration, there's a Mr. Timmons says that because of the underlying incident in which Mr. Bohinsky called Mr. Timmons a rat and a snitch, Mr. Timmons was treated with hostility by other prisoners. And so I think, again, that kind of supports the idea that there could be this relationship between the things that the prison employees are saying, how other folks in the prison are reacting. That supports the underlying merits of his First Amendment and Eighth Amendment claim, both of which I think ultimately hinge on the effect of calling someone a rat and a snitch in front of other folks in the prison. So I do think that there is a potential intertwinement argument, but I think it would really benefit from briefing and consideration by the district court on remand.
Thank you. Let's hear from Ms. Kogan and we'll get you back on rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Hannah Kogan and I am a Deputy Attorney General with the Office of Attorney General here representing Appellee Bohinsky. The district court correctly granted summary judgment for Bohinsky after concluding that Timmons' claims were barred due to his failure to exhaust available administrative remedies as required by the PLRA. There's no dispute that Timmons never completed DOC's grievance process with respect to his underlying claims. Timmons purports that administrative remedies were unavailable because some unnamed John Doe correctional officers on two occasions thwarted or otherwise threatened him from lodging a grievance in June 2021 against Bohinsky. But as set forth in Rinaldi, it is Timmons' burden to demonstrate unavailability, and his lone, vague, self-serving affidavit is insufficient to meet his burden. I, at the outset, also want to make very clear that it is not Bohinsky's position that an affidavit on its own cannot suffice at summary judgment to overcome a well-supported summary judgment motion, for one. Second, identifying by name the prison staff that thwarted or otherwise prevented an inmate from throwing away his grievance or from lodging his grievance. The name that is obviously that was preferred and should be there, but it's not absolutely required. What does need to be there is enough to put the defendants or corrections defendants on notice.
Help me understand why that doesn't exist. You have two incidents. He says what happened in the incidents. He gives you the date of the incidents, where they occur. How is that conclusory? When you look at our case law about, you know, what conclusory affidavits are, I'm struggling to see how that's conclusory.
I understand district court use conclusory, and I do think there are aspects of the declaration that are conclusory. I would prefer or suggest that it is rather a mere scintilla and just simply not enough to provide John Doe and a block and a date. We don't have a shift or time of day. We don't have a gender or sex. It needs to contain enough specific facts or be narrow enough that corrections defendants do not need to go on a fishing expedition on an inmate's behalf.
Is there anything that we could look to in the record to suggest that it would really be a fishing expedition? And your friend on the other side laid out, posited how discovery around this issue might work. It could be limited to a day. You know where the facility would know where Timmons was on that day. Like, it seems knowable. I mean, we have cases, I think Palladino talks about whether there are gaps in the reliability of prison's record keeping structure and that being potentially an issue to summary judgment. And so this just, it seems knowable, not a fishing expedition. Is there something that we're missing on that?
I believe a bit, Your Honor, because it is a bit of a fishing expedition. We don't even know, based on the declaration, if these John Does were John Does that were assigned to that block, right? So they could have been any kind of prison staff that may have been temporarily going through that block on that day.
So it's the prisoner's burden to know who is going through that day, who's on, you know, who's, whether it's a new corrections officer, whether a person, because there's a shortage, it's the prisoner's burden to know that and include that?
It's the prisoner's burden to demonstrate unavailability under Rinaldi, and with the benefit of discovery, which Timmons did have here and was well aware of the affirmative defense asserted by Bohinsky, he had the opportunity through discovery to request all the things that, honestly, my friend on the other side has suggested. Shift loss, video surveillance, any of those things could have been requested in discovery, and Timmons did not do that. It was his burden under Rinaldi to demonstrate unavailability. And that
I think Rinaldi is pretty specific about what that burden means, and we've referenced it. There's a subjective prong and an objective prong, and you know, there's language around both those prongs, but I don't think they get to the level of specificity that you're suggesting. Is there another case that builds out Rinaldi that gets us closer to the type of burden on a pro se plaintiff that you're suggesting?
Sure. So in terms of just the burden shifting, because I would agree, Your Honor, there's the initial question of, is there enough evidence to create a genuine dispute of material fact, and that they've established both the objective and the subjective prongs. But in preparing for oral argument, I think it is a bit reminiscent of McDonnell Douglas, that burden shifting of, once you have the legitimate business reason from the employer, the burden shifts to the plaintiff to demonstrate that it was mere pretext for an intentional discrimination claim or pretext under pretext theory. So here it's that same idea where they need to at least show enough, more than a mere scintilla, a prisoner in this case, that it was unavailable. And I think that I don't have a case necessarily, I think, directly on point, Your Honor, but I would revert back to both Williams and Niffes, both say you need more than a mere scintilla. It is true that oftentimes all we can expect from a prisoner may oftentimes be a summary judgment is a declaration, but that still is not enough if it's only...
It's the prisoner's declaration in a case where the very theory of unavailability is the more discovery that I did into this issue, the more threats I would face.
I'm sorry, the more discovery, can you repeat that?
If the more things I do to publicly show myself in this facility as a snitch or a rat, the more risk that I subject myself to. Is that not-
I believe that's a little bit mixing the underlying claim. Bohinsky is the one that called him a rat or snitch. And then separately, you have the exhaustion question, which I think this goes a little bit to Pertu too, and why they actually are not.
I don't think it mixes it at all. The whole concept, the incentives that his theory creates are that people said to him, if you pursue these grievances and these theories, we will put you in positions that subject you to physical harm. And so it just seems odd to me that a court, or frankly, the stewards of the facility would put prisoners in a position where we're creating law that says, even though this is your factual theory of the case, that you were being subjected to physical safety risks by pursuing these claims, we should make you prisoner, go depose these guys and sit there yourself in a pro se capacity and call them out publicly and risk yourself to more of exactly what's set out in this declaration. I don't think that's mixing the issue. I think that is the issue.
Well, I guess, Your Honor, so it's a bit circular to me then that if he's so scared to file a grievance, but he's not scared enough to file a federal lawsuit.
No, it's not circular. What's consistent is he doesn't want to file a grievance and he doesn't want to depose people and send a bunch of subpoenas that will cause those people to come after him again. And, you know, we credit his theories at this posture. And I think those are the incentives that they're consistent across the board.
Right, but a plaintiff is not, even a pro se plaintiff, is not excused from prosecuting his case. And so if he's scared of deposing, again, we don't know who these John Does are, so I can't even give you a name, but he can request shift logs, he can request video surveillance, he can request other things if he does have any fear. He can ask for appointment of counsel, or he can ask for protective orders if he's scared. He can ask... request maybe a transfer from the prison because of this, because he fears for his safety. There are a lot of different aspects, both within the prison and through the process of just litigation, that a plaintiff has access to.
Is there anything in the record about the facility taking efforts to identify these people to show us that it would have actually been a fishing expedition or futile?
No, Your Honor. If anything, it would have been helpful maybe if he had filed separate grievances saying John Doe threw away my grievance, and we would have actually maybe had a name there.
My question is a little different. In the litigation, did Bohinsky seek through discovery to identify the people referenced the timing is different because he raised it in the summary judgment in response to the summary judgment motion.
No, Your Honor. So the answer is no. Bohinsky did not endeavor to find out who these John Does are because, again, there was simply not enough evidence or sufficient facts by Timmons to begin with. And these are the same facts or statements that were made at the pleading stage. And the district court said in denying our motion to dismiss that this was enough at the pleading stage, but in fact may not be at the summary judgment stage. That was in footnote 2 of the district court opinion below for the denial of the motion to dismiss. So Timmons was otherwise well aware that, okay, you've had enough here to overcome a motion to dismiss, but it may not be enough at the summary judgment stage later on. And again, it's his burden under Rinaldi to demonstrate unavailability, to establish that. So it is not corrections defendants going through an entire day in an entire facility trying to determine who a John Doe correctional officer or corrections staff is. That's not enough essentially to equate to notice or otherwise do anything more than a fishing expedition.
Just want to make sure I understand. Your position is not that Timmons' declaration is not competent evidence, right? It's just that it's not enough. It's not weighty. It's a scintilla. It's not weighty enough.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But it's a competent declaration.
Correct. And the district court considered it and deemed it not enough. They said, I believe at the end of the opinion, it was insufficient to create a genuine material fact to send this case to a fact finder. And I think I just want to get into a little bit about the next steps in this process regarding Small, Palladino, and Purtue here. It is only once a plaintiff like Timmons has sufficient evidence to create a genuine dispute of material fact on availability that we then have a dispute of fact that must be resolved by a fact finder. Under Palladino and Small, that fact finder can be the district court judge.
Yeah.
And here we did not, the district court did. Right.
Your position is that the plaintiff has to survive a summary judgment motion before the district court has the option to resolve the legal question of exhaustion?
Survive the summary judgment, and by survive summary judgment, I would just define that as they're creating a genuine dispute of material fact on the availability question and that legal question.
Where do you read that? Where do you read that requirement in any of those opinions?
I would just say that's Rinaldi and the summary judgment standard on its own. The resolution on the question of availability is resolved by a fact finder only once traditional summary judgment standard, once there's a genuine dispute of material fact to be resolved where reasonable minds can differ. That fact finder under Smaller Palladino can be the district court judge. Purtue says that when the exhaustion issue is intertwined with the underlying merits, that it needs to go to a jury and the district court judge cannot sit as the fact finder. And I would just, on the Purtue point, while I understand it wasn't fully briefed on the question of whether or not they are intertwined, I would just suggest to this court, it is not intertwined. In Purtue, yes, it was a retaliation claim, but the claim in itself was that the named defendant, defendant Purtue, was the one intercepting and destroying the inmates' grievances. And so if a judge sitting as the fact finder was adjudicating the exhaustion issue, the judge would be implicitly also adjudicating the underlying merits of the First Amendment retaliation claim. That's when you can tell it is intertwined. Here we don't have that. We have Bohinsky allegedly calling Timmons a rat or a snitch, and that's the merits claim here. But as to the exhaustion issue, we have separate John Does, or potentially the John Does could be the same. We don't know if it's even a different John Doe. We have John Does threatening or thwarting his ability to file the initial grievance. That's separate. It can be resolved by a district court judge under Smaller Palladino without it being intertwined with the underlying rat or snitch name calling First Amendment retaliation claim.
I'm sure you know this, Lidge, but you know, Palladino says that a single non-conclusory affidavit or witness's testimony, when based on personal knowledge and directed at a material issue, is sufficient to defeat summary judgment, even if it's self-serving. Why doesn't that describe this declaration?
Because I believe in there was still sufficient. Mm-hmm. And yes, a self-serving affidavit oftentimes, many affidavits are self-serving, yeah, of course, but it still needs to contain enough specific facts or be narrow enough to meet that initial burden that a plaintiff or prisoner under PLRA has to demonstrate unavailability.
Why isn't that initial burden just non-conclusory?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why isn't that burden just non-conclusory? The allegations have to be non-conclusory. It sounds like you're asking us to say that something is needed other than a non-conclusory affidavit.
I would say it needs to be non-conclusory. It needs to not be vague, and here it's definitely vague. I'm so sorry, I see my time is up.
Can okay,
I,
go ahead.
It needs to not be vague, and here it's undoubtedly vague when he's saying John Doe's, and doesn't have it. I don't think this court needs to give a bright line, Your Honor, about what exactly X, Y, Z, A, B, C, D is all needed for an affidavit to suffice, but it does need to be more than a mere scintilla, and I think district courts are well-suited and well-acquainted with determining when that line is surpassed or not.
Thank you.
Good
Okay.
I'd like to make hopefully 4 points. I'll try to be concise. First, just in terms of what the district court actually did here, I read the opinion to say after saying, you know, he didn't specify what was written in the grievances, didn't show that he tried to learn the identity of the officers, quote, the court is thus left with nothing other than Timmons' conclusory, unsupported, and self-serving affidavit, which the court finds insufficient. So I don't know that it'll, you know, I think that's what the district court was purporting to do. Second, on the mere scintilla sort of idea, first, for the reasons that have been aired out about the specific facts contained in this declaration, and the reasons that we discussed when I was up here before, I think the declaration gives enough detail to ensure that no fishing expedition is necessary. The cases, the NIFAS case in particular that my friend on the other side cites, is really distinct from this case. In that case, two different legal theories, and the declarations didn't contain sufficient, they didn't contain any specific facts that would have actually established the legal violation. One of the legal violations was unauthorized disclosure of medical information, and there weren't any facts in the declaration actually saying that the medical information was disclosed to people who were not part of the medical care treatment team, right? So I just don't think that that's the universe that we're in. Third, on the idea that there's only a mere scintilla in this declaration, and that it's vague because of the John Doe identities we discussed at length, sort of absence of legal relevance to that. And I just want to note, there is no other area of the law where, because you can't name a defendant or a relevant person in a lawsuit, right? I think about civil rights law, John Doe defendants, like that. This would be a real departure from a really common practice in federal court litigation. Next, on the burden question, I just want to emphasize again that I agree that there is a burden-shifting mechanism on the ultimate merits here, but that needs to be viewed through the lens of the summary judgment standard. And then I'll end on this set of discovery-related issues. First, there's nothing in the record suggesting that Mr. Bohinsky engaged in any discovery at all.
He didn't have to. I mean, I think the state's position is it's your burden. We're going to sit back and see what he can come up with.
I was responding to the direct question that Your Honor posed. This was an affirmative defense that Mr. Timmons did not have to plead. Mr. Bohinsky raised it at the motion to dismiss stage. Mr. Timmons then responded with a declaration. The district court, I think, I just want to say exactly what the district court said at that point, which was, you know, a declaration alone without other facts may be enough at summary judgment. And that's not saying that it definitely is. It's not telling Mr. Timmons he needed to do more. And even if it had been, the district court can't impose a bespoke burden that isn't just the summary judgment standard. So I don't think that that's relevant. I think that that's a red herring. Mr. Timmons had evidence about what he needed to show. He didn't have to do discovery to find more. He had the evidence that this court has said on multiple occasions is about what we can expect within his position, and we ask this court vacate and remand.
If we have like a Title VII case and the plaintiff's allegation is that he or she overheard someone in the workplace, you know, make a racial slur, and that's the entirety of the plaintiff's evidence, would that be enough?
I don't have the, you know, the exact elements of a Title VII, you know, totally.
It's really a summary judgment question, not a Title VII question.
Yeah, right. No, so what I was going to say is I think that if the merits of the claim could be resolved by just the existence of a slur, then I think that that could survive summary judgment. But I think actually what you probably need is, you know, a causal connection, or you need some evidence, you know, there needs to be a hook to, you know, whatever, an adverse employment action. Here, all of the facts that would make up the actual legal violation, or not legal violation because it's not the merits, but that would make up the availability question are in the declaration. So I think that would be the difference, is are there enough facts aimed toward the material, the elements, the material issues.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter.